password can I steal? And then once I have that, what access does that give me? So I think it's important to talk about it from that perspective. If you're thinking maybe you want to get into pen testing, this is definitely going to be something, a skill you're going to want to have. I think on the flip side of that, if you're like a network administrator or you're a domain administrator, if you're in charge of defending your environment, then it really benefits you to kind of understand how someone might crack passwords and reuse them in your network. And then lastly, right, we all have our personal accounts. You can't really sign up for anything on the internet anymore without like username and password. So I think it kind of benefits all of us, you know, sort of on that personal level, to kind of understand how we can create stronger passwords or how someone might kind of steal and reuse our passwords. And I forgot to start the timer. So sorry about that, but I'll try to keep everything as on time as possible. So whenever we're talking about password cracking, there's really kind of two main types of password cracking. We're going to try to cover both of these today, so we're going to be moving pretty quickly. But we have our offline password cracking, and in this case, we've already stolen the password, but we have it in like a hashed format. And you know, it's all about cracking that hash. So we'll talk about what hashes are and how we can track those down. And then we have our online password guessing, which is, or our online password cracking, which is really kind of password guessing against a resource over a network. And most often, that might be like a website over the internet, not always. In our example, it'll be a web application, but sometimes that could be something like an SSH server as well. So let's kind of start with our cracking hashed passwords. What are hashed passwords? Hashed passwords are what are stored locally on a system, or what, or the format that passwords are stored in a password database. Hashes just are functions that are applied to clear text strings, which in our case are passwords. So we kind of have like a graphic or an illustration here of what it looks like when we log into a computer or our banking website or any kind of application. You know, we type in our password, hello, for the example here. The application takes that clear text password and it passes it through a hashing function, and then we get this string in red out the other side. And that doesn't look anything like our password. That's our hashed password. That's the password in its hashed form. The application then takes the hash it just got and it compares it to the hash that it has in its password database. And if those two hashes match, if they're identical, then the application knows that we gave it the correct password, it logs us in, and we go on. So the hash passwords are what are should be stored on a system or stored in a password database. Just another thing to be aware of, there are different types of hashes. Today we don't really have time to kind of talk in depth about each one, but these are probably common types of hashes that we'll see. Today we're going to kind of look at bcrypt and SHA-1 hashes because those are what we have access to. But you know, keep in mind as you're looking at things or if you see a system, if someone says, you know, well, our product protects its password with secure SHA-1 hashes, that should be a red flag. SHA-1 has been deprecated now, and as we'll see, that's a pretty weak hashing algorithm. SHA-512 is what Ubuntu will hash its passwords with by default, so that's another one you might see. NTLM is the hashing format that Windows workstations and servers will use. And that one is unfortunately pretty easy to crack, but you have to have extracted that password somehow. So when we're talking about cracking these hashes, you know, I think we should talk about what that means or what specifically we're doing. So let's just say we have this target hash here. We've pulled it off of a system and we're gonna try to crack it. But we don't know anything about it other than that's the hash value right there. So we might guess that it's the word password with a capital P, and we'll hash it, and that's the string below, and we'll compare those two hashes, and they don't match. So we'll guess it's password 1 with a capital P, we hash it, and they don't match. We'll guess maybe it's password 01, we hash that, and it doesn't match. Until finally, we guess that it's password 001, we hash that word, and we see that our two hashes that match. So we know that our guess of password 001 is the correct password that we cracked it then. So it's kind of like when we have the hash password, we kind of take that process of logging in, right, and sort of turn it around. We're feeding our computer guesses and it's hashing them and comparing them. So what kind of tools do we use to do this? Hashcat and John the Ripper are probably the two most popular. They're also free, so we'll be using Hashcat today. But I think Lockcrack deserves mention too. Lockcrack is a paid tool, but it has a pretty nice agent for extracting hash passwords out of the domain controller. So maybe if you're doing something like a domain password audit, that's a pretty nice paid tool for that. And then hardware-wise, we really just want a PC with a decent video card. So let's talk quickly about why that's important. That seems kind of like a weird requirement, right? A traditional desktop computer might have 4 cores, maybe 8 if you've got like some hyper-threading, but GPUs have hundreds of smaller cores. They're much better suited for this type of work. They're kind of designed for what the video card manufacturers call parallel computation, and that really just means, you know, doing a lot of small similar tasks in parallel or at the same time. And so if you remember, you know, kind of what we're doing when we're cracking, we're just guessing a word, hashing it, comparing it, right? Guessing a word, hashing it, comparing it. So our video cards are very well suited for this kind of work. And I included a benchmark at the bottom, hopefully you guys can see it here. In this case, the guy was trying to crack a Office 2013 hash. And so he uses his Intel Xeon processor, that's a server CPU, and he can guess about 30 passwords per second. He uses a GTX 750 Ti, and he gets up to about 1200. He goes to a 980, he gets about 3800 passwords per second. And then on the GTX 1080, he gets about 7100 passwords per second. If you're someone who's not too familiar with video cards, you know, just the big one at the bottom there, a GTX 1080, that's about $500. So not, you know, we're not talking like super computer hardware. You don't need a lot of hardware to do this kind of stuff. In our demo, we'll be using a GTX 1050 Ti. I think I got that off a Newegg for like $200. So it's very reasonable. And I think, as we'll see, if your passwords are poor, we can crack them down pretty quickly. So, So I'm using Hashcat. Hashcat claims to be the world's fastest password recovery tool. They say that because they use the GPU cracking. I think they were kind of first to do that. It's open source, meaning it's free. It won't cost you anything. And it's pre-installed on Kali Linux. So if you can boot up an ISO, you really already have the software that you need. So we'll kind of talk really quickly about how Hashcat cracks passwords down so quickly. It supports a number of different attack modes, but today we'll be using a word list attack because this is probably the most common way to crack passwords. We're just going to feed Hashcat a list of words. It's going to hash all those words, and if any of our passwords are those words, we'll have cracked them. This used to be kind of called a dictionary attack because people would feed in dictionary words. But it's not really effective to use a dictionary. We have word lists like RockYou and CrackStation, and they're made up of passwords that have come out of other password breaches. So if you're kind of in the habit of reusing your passwords, if we have your password in one of these lists, we can crack it down pretty quickly. Other things we'll do, there's a script called Cool. You can take that and point it at a website, and it will grab all of the words out of that website. So if the employees of a particular company are kind of creating passwords based on company keywords, we can kind of crack them down that way. Another cool script is called Wordsmith. You can fire that up and say, give me a word list for Bismarck, and it will grab all of the publicly available like geolocation data that it can find. So it'll give you every street name, names of landmarks, sports teams, you know, like the rivers of Missouri River would show up in there, and you can create a word list based on that. And the guys that created that script found that that's a pretty effective way to crack passwords. Where our word lists start to get kind of interesting is we can extend our word list with what Hashcat calls rules. So this gets pretty effective, right? Because we've kind of been told that in order for our passwords to be secure, you know, we need numbers, we need special characters, we need all that crazy stuff. And the easiest way for a lot of people to do that is just kind of some of these common character substitutions. But with rules, we can tell Hashcat to automatically do those character substitutions for the words in our word list. And that starts to become pretty effective. So we'll see what that looks like. So where can we get our hash passwords? Where do they come from? You know, on the personal side, and maybe on the enterprise side, right? Because sometimes there's some overlap if people are reusing passwords. There's been a lot of data breaches, so that's certainly a place that we can go look for users' passwords. We'll take a look at the LinkedIn data breach. That's where I pulled our sample passwords from. And I have a copy of the Dropbox as well, so we can take a look at that quick. And then on the enterprise side, you know, these are just kind of common areas that I've seen on certain pen tests. So IPMI version 2 devices, those are HP ILO cards or Dell iDRAC cards. Those are called BMCs, baseboard management controllers, and they're basically small computers that sit on the back of servers, and you can plug them in. They get their own Ethernet interface. And if you use those, it's very nice. As an administrator, you can remotely reboot a server, power it on if it's turned off. Sometimes they'll even give you console access to the server. So if you're an admin, this is very nice. But older versions of the device, they actually leaked their hash password by design. And so I've seen cases where the password set on that device is the same admin password for everything. So that's nice. You can get the password there, crack it down, and reuse it. Miscellaneous config backups. I've seen cases where I found backups for Cisco devices, for example. If you've worked with Cisco, you know the configuration is clear text, except for the password that's hashed. But I've found backups on shared folders, taken that password, cracked it, and that was the same password for all the Cisco devices. So that's kind of cool. Linux servers, if you have root access to the box, then you can grab the Etsy shadow file, and then you can start cracking those down. And then Windows workstations. Again, if you're running a system, there are tools to extract the hash passwords from there. And then there is this. So hopefully this hasn't been beaten to death today. I know Slade brought it up, and I know Tim Jensen brought it up. But the reason that we keep on bringing up the NetBIOS name resolution and the link local multicast name resolution poisoning is that, like those guys said, most pen testers, when they get access to a network, this is the first thing that they're going to try to do. So Windows workstations have these two services enabled by default. And if an attacker is sharing the network, they can intercept these messages to get the user's hashed password. So I've done a number of pen tests where, you know, we find an open jack, plug my laptop in, run the script, in 15 minutes, you know, you have a couple hashed passwords. Feed those into Hashcat, see which ones you can crack. One cracked, okay, now I have someone's credentials. That's a pretty common technique for a lot of pen testers. So again, definitely want to try to disable those two services. So like I mentioned, we will crack down some passwords from the LinkedIn data breach. So this is kind of my placeholder slide. Overall, 164 million records were leaked. Initially, they were breached in 2012. But the data breach itself wasn't really available publicly until around 2016. So the data is a little bit older, but still easy, should be pretty easy to find online, I think. So I'm gonna pause this and we'll jump out. So hopefully my screen is mirrored here. So we're not going to be doing any cracking on my laptop, right? We're kind of, hopefully you guys can see that. BombGuard is kind of what we use to remote into stuff. So we're remoted into my computer in Fargo. This is just a PC running Ubuntu. I think it has like Core i3 processor, maybe like 8 gigs of RAM, and then that GTX 1050 Ti. So again, like not super computer level stuff. This thing was in the junk pile. I found it and put a video card in it. So you don't need a crazy amount of hardware for this. So I guess hopefully you guys can see that the resolution got a little wonky, but we're in the LinkedIn folder, which was the LinkedIn data breach. It just came as a giant zip. I think it's like 30 gigs total. If we look inside of it, all it really is just these weird text files. They're just numbered. Let's just take like the first 10 lines out of one of these. And hopefully you guys can see that. This is what all of these text files are. They're just an email address, colon, and then the string at the end here. And that string right here, you know, that's our hash password right there. And in this case, they were using SHA-1 hashes. So they're 40 characters in length, but that is the entirety. So this whole data breach is 30 gigs of just kind of this stuff, basically. So 30 gigs in text. So let's crack some of these down, I guess. So I'm just gonna move up. So again, like I said, we're running on Ubuntu here, so this is Linux. So if I want to start Hashcat, I'm going to run the binary. Hashcat will run on Windows, so if you're doing this on Windows, it's just going to be hashcat64.exe, but again, because we're on Windows, it's hashcat64.bin. We have to give it an attack mode, and so the first thing that we're going to try is just the plain wordless attack. So we're going to feed Hashcat a list of hashes and a word list, and if any of the hash passwords are in our word list, we'll have cracked them. But I guess for that to make sense, let's take a look at the hashes first. So I have a file called demo.hash. And if we look at that, it's literally just the list of these hashes. So this is the format that Hashcat wants. It doesn't care about the email addresses at all. It doesn't want them in its input file. So you kind of have to clean that up yourself. But literally right here, just a list of these hashes. And then let's maybe look at the first 20 lines of the Rocky word list, because that's the one that we'll use. So again, it's literally just a list of words. And all of these words, all these passwords, they've come from some other data breach somewhere else. This is a pretty popular word list. Again, it's pretty old too, but can still be effective, especially when we extend it with our rules, like we'll see. So hopefully that makes a little bit more sense. So our attack mode is going to be zero. That's our plain wordless attack. We have to give it a hash type, which Hashcat can crack, I think, maybe like 100 different types of hashes. So 100 just happens to be the SHA-1 hash. So we need to specify that. And then we need to give it our word list. And that's it. That's the command. So we can run that. And if I put everything in correctly, it'll run. And so we can see it's kicking passwords out to the screen. Like I said, sorry, the resolution is a little wonky. So total, that took us like 4 seconds to run. And in that time, we had 710 passwords in our sample set, and we were able to recover 135 of them, or 19%. But if you think about that, right, every password that we just cracked was already in our word list. So these are obviously pretty bad passwords. But we can look at them quick. So Hashcat just outputs them to the screen and writes them to a file. But we can still look at these. You know, a lot of these, like Diacode and Welcome's one, these are pretty poor passwords. In addition to already being in our word list, they definitely seem to lack a lot of complexity. So that was fun. So now the next thing I want to do is I'm going to switch the attack mode. Hashcat calls this a hybrid attack. And we're going to say, OK, for every word in that word list, let's just add one of every special character, one of every number, one of every uppercase, one of every lowercase. So Hashcat's going to automatically take one of every possible character combination and just add it to every word in our word list. And this can be kind of effective sometimes, right? If you have that special character requirement, sometimes people like to just like sneak an exclamation on at the end of passwords. I know I've done that before. So that's a common thing I like to check for. So if we look again, this time the attack ran in 2 seconds. So there's kind of a weird trade-off. If you don't give Hashcat enough work to do it, it sort of becomes less efficient. So we increased the amount of work to do, and it took half the time. So we'll see if we can flip that around. So this time we have 175 cracked. I think last time we were at 19%, now we're at 24%, so we got like another 5% of passwords. And we saw some come out on the screen. And so now you can see, I think here's a pretty good example, like this password, Jonas12$. So the password Jonas12 with a capital J, that was in our word list, but not Jonas12$, right? We got there by kind of telling Hashcat, hey, just automatically add that stuff to your word list. And then, you know, same thing here, right? Like one exclamation. Cupcakes1 was in our word list, but not Cupcakes1 exclamation. And that, I guess, this one I think is kind of a good example too. This right here is like a pattern that I'll look for. So the LinkedIn data breach is a little bit older, right? But if we were doing a pen test for a company, we would want to look for their employees' records in here. So let's say, hypothetically, we cracked down one of the employees' records and their password was cupcakes1$. Okay, well, we can try that against maybe an email portal and it won't work. But maybe the next thing I'll try is, you know, like cupcakes to at or something. You know, I'll just kind of go down the keyboard because the one and the exclamation, those are the same keys, right? It's just it's a shift difference. If you type out cupcakes one, shift. So that's like a pattern I would kind of look for. You know, I would go to at, three, pound, four, dollar. And then maybe in that case, the user is kind of creating predictable passwords. So that's something that we definitely want to look for. So we can keep going in the same pattern. So now I can tell Hashcat, okay, let's just add two of every possible character combination to the end of every word in the word list. And we can see now here we're still getting more passwords. I don't know if this will complete very quickly though. So yes, I'll quit it here. So in that case, right, we stopped it early. We're up to 30%, so we still got like another, 5% of our passwords recovered. But in this case, right, it wanted to run for roughly about 2 minutes. So there's definitely like a trade-off here. Once your word lists start to get too big, you know, then it can become a little bit unmanageable. Certainly 2 minutes is definitely still reasonable, but you know, sometimes I see people think, you know, oh, I'm just going to feed it this massive word list. Well, that's still going to take time unless you have, you know, just a lot of hardware to throw at it. I think our CrackStation word list is a 14 gig word list. And so maybe just for comparison, we can try that one as well. And just see how long that'll take to get through. Yeah, so that'll take about 4 minutes. So again, that's pretty reasonable, but you know, there definitely is a trade-off there.
I have that somewhere.
So again, maybe we'll scroll up on it. So again, we can look at some of the passwords that we got. So I guess I think this one's a pretty good example, Kalamazoo 01. So the length is there. But you know, kind of the issue is that, well, the issue with all of these passwords is they're almost all entirely based up on a single word, right? So even with some of the special characters and some of the numbers that we're seeing here, you know, the base for that password kind of already exists within our word list. So by making a couple of quick permutations, we were able to recover those passwords pretty quickly. One other example I wanted to call out. So one other thing I just wanted to make note of, we'll try Wisconsin 5% as an example. But again, that's another good one, right? The 5 key and the percent key are the same. So, you know, if that one didn't work, I'd maybe try Wisconsin 6 caret or Wisconsin 7 ampersand. But if we take this thing and we go to like one of these password strength checkers, sometimes that we see on websites, I think I had so yeah, we'll try Wisconsin 5%. We'll paste it in here and we'll see what it says. And so, oh, okay. Well, that would take a computer 400 years to crack. Well, we know that's not true, right? So that's kind of the thing, you know, beware of some of this stuff. So kind of, you know, they're thinking about the password from a math perspective, right? So looking at the length of the password. But they're really not considering like a word list type attack or an offline password attack. And if someone gets a hold of your hash password, that's what they're going to try to do first because it works and it's going to give you the quickest results. So, you know, again, I think sometimes people see these things and they get led astray a little bit. So just something to keep in mind. Oops, that's for the next demo. One other thing I wanted to show you. I mentioned we'd look at the Dropbox data breach. So that one's similar. Maybe I'll clear this. If you look in the Dropbox folder, I don't think it was as big, but there's only 4 text files here. And you can see the first two, start with BF, and then the next two start with SHA-1. So the Dropbox thing is kind of interesting. They were actually in the middle of changing how they hash their passwords while they were breached. So half of the passwords came out in SHA-1 hashes, and the other half came out in salted bcrypt hashes. And so that's pretty cool to look at. I think we can kind of compare the two and see the difference. So I have a bcrypt hash as well. We'll jump back up. And if we look at our bcrypt hash, this is actually the bcrypt hash for my password. We can see that that looks quite a bit different than our SHA-1 hash, right? Our SHA-1 hashes are always 40 characters in length, and they don't have special characters in them, whereas the bcrypt kind of does. So sometimes people ask me, well, how do I know if I'm looking at a hash, if it is? A lot of that's going to depend on where the hash came from. So usually if you have a hash, you know where it came from. But length can be a pretty good indicator too. So I forgot the hash type though, so we'll see if I can find it here. 3200. So we're just going to run the same attack that we initially ran. We're just going to do a plain word list attack against this bcrypt hash, and we'll see how long it takes us. So hash type is different. Use our bcrypt hash. And we'll use the same word list. We'll use our docu word list again, and we'll run this. And we'll see what happens. And so nothing happens, right? It hasn't cracked anything yet, but it is working. Whoops. And if I check the status on it, we'll check that again. So if we check the status on this, we can see that the exact same attack that took us like 4 seconds to run initially, I think, is going to take us like 8 hours to run against a bcrypt hash. So when people talk about strong hashing algorithms, like this is the difference that they're talking about there. 8 hours is like still pretty reasonable, especially if, you know, we have nothing but time, but this is certainly going to slow down the number of guesses that we can do. And as we make our word list longer, this is going to take even longer as well. So there again, kind of important point. That's why people are saying use the strong hashing algorithms, like bcrypt. So we'll leave that alone for now, and I think I have to start back at the top. Yeah, I haven't found a way to pause a PowerPoint and then resume from where you were, so if anyone knows how to do that, I would really be curious to know. So how do we protect our own passwords from something like this? There's a website, haveibeenpwned.com. It's ran by a guy named Troy. He kind of aggregates all these data breaches and lets you search for your own records in there. I would definitely check there. That's how I found my own records in the LinkedIn and Dropbox, so that's a good place to start. Again, think about using multi-factor wherever possible. You know, personally, I try to use it everywhere, but like at a minimum on anything banking, social media, and personal email, because that's really probably your important stuff. You can use the site twofactorauth.org, and they'll tell you which websites support it. Start thinking about password raises, right? So just like Slade said this morning, 15 characters is a pretty good place to start. Longer passwords are almost always stronger. And then lastly, right, think about using a password manager. Password managers will let you set unique passwords per website that you use. So even if somebody does compromise the website, they get the password out of there and they crack it down, well, it was only the password for that website, which you already had. So it doesn't really matter in that case anyway. What can we do for our environment? It's a lot of the same advice. Have I Been Pwned will also let you check a domain. So if I can prove ownership of highpointnetworks.com, he'll give me a report of anyone with the highpointnetworks.com email address and what data breaches they've been in. So it's kind of nice to inform people that way. Again, think about the MFA on anything external. Consider enterprise password managers. Labs is a pretty cool tool for Microsoft. It's free, and it allows you to create unique local administrative passwords per Windows device. So that's pretty cool. I've done pen tests where you compromise a Windows machine, you get the local admin password, but it doesn't matter because you can't use it to log in anything else. That really cuts down on the lateral movement. And again, passphrases, right? 15 characters is a good place to start. Again, on the NetBIOS name resolution, link local multicast, turn them off. I had a customer ask me about NAC. Like, well, so the argument is, well, if I can just stop you from getting onto my network, then you can't perform the attack. Yes, I agree with that. So NAC is kind of a solution that way, but you still need to think about users that are taking laptops to like coffee shops and airport networks. If you're in a hostile network, somebody could still potentially perform that attack. So something to think about. So we got 15 minutes left. We're going to try to get through all the online password cracking as well. So online password cracking, we have the same goal. I want valid credentials. I want usernames and passwords that I can use to log into stuff. But the username piece is what we might spend a lot of time trying to find. So we need to find a way to harvest usernames out of either a web app or an application. Popular examples I like to look at Outlook web app a lot because, as we'll see in our demo, it will let you enumerate usernames from it. But SSH servers, sometimes we see those are exposed on the internet. And I think there was a vulnerability about a month or two ago where OpenSSH versions less than 7.7 also kind of had a behavior where you could enumerate usernames. So if we are going to enumerate usernames, we kind of need to figure out the format in which usernames are created. But fortunately, administrators use usually a common method, usually first name dot last name, or first initial last name. And if we're really lucky, the usernames are in the same format as the email address. And if that's the case, then we just kind of go digging for email addresses. So we can look on Google, we can look on LinkedIn. There's a Python script called the Harvester that kind of automates that for us. It won't grab you everything, but it'll get you started. So once we've got some usernames, then we want to see if they're valid. So one thing we might do, you really don't see this too commonly anymore, but maybe the login page itself will tell us if the usernames are valid or not. And this is an old screenshot from SurveyMonkey. You can see here, if you put in a username that doesn't exist, it tells you, hey, that doesn't exist. So for us, that's awesome. Now we can just feed this thing a list of potential usernames, and the web page itself will tell us which ones are valid and which ones are invalid. So this is kind of why now, if you notice a lot of web apps, their messages are more vague. It might say something like invalid credentials or invalid username or password. This is kind of why, so that we can't enumerate usernames. Other places we might check, password reset pages I've seen. So sometimes when you can reset an account, it'll start out with the username, and if the username doesn't exist, it'll just tell you. And so that's handy, that's another place we can check for this. And then lastly, and kind of the harder one to find, is there a slight timing difference in giving the website a valid username versus an invalid username? And so you can't really see that, right? But this is kind of like a chunk of pseudocode, we'll call it. This isn't real code, but this is maybe some logic on the web application behind that means. So when we log in, they have this function, check creds, and it gets passed a username and a password. The first thing it does is try to look up the user, and if the user is valid, then it hashes the password and compares the hashes, just like our login process from earlier. But it's kind of, see if I can, maybe I can draw on it here. So it's kind of like this, oh, that's kind of cool. So it's kind of like that logic right there. If the user exists, then hash the password, but if not, then you drop out of the function. Right? And so that the hashing of the password, that might give us a slight timing difference that we can measure with a script or an application. And we saw how, you know, SHA-1 hashes or weak hashes, those are pretty easy to crack, right? So the recommendation is use something strong like bcrypt. Well, if we have web developers that are, you know, they want to do security, they want to do the right thing, so they're just switching hashing algorithms over, then you might be introducing this kind of behavior into a web app. Because a stronger hashing algorithm takes more CPU cycles to compute. So if we're just switching out hashing algorithms, you might be like unknowingly introducing this kind of behavior. So that's kind of a weird thing to look for. So if we think we see that in a web app, then we want to put together a list of potential usernames. For that, US Census data up until 1990 is publicly available, and that's what we'll use. And so we're just going to use, we're going to use that data, generate a massive list of potential usernames, and just feed it into the application, and the application will tell us which users are valid. Once we have a list of valid users, then we're going to kind of do what we call password spraying. And so we do password spraying when we want to work around account lockouts. So traditionally, when we would brute force an account, right, you might have like one username and you guess hundreds or maybe thousands of passwords for that same username. So what do? To protect that, we lock out accounts. So with password spraying, we're kind of turning that logic around now. Instead of guessing hundreds or thousands of passwords for one account, we're going to guess, we have hopefully hundreds of accounts, maybe it's 100, maybe it's 50, and we're just going to guess the same password for every single one of those users. And now it's a numbers game, basically. It's who has the password that I can guess. And so common guesses that we'll use, you know, like season year is pretty common, like summer 2018 or maybe fall 2018 now. Month year, so like October 2018 would be a good one to try. Sometimes company name 123, or you know, just the super easy, just password 123. The season year becomes pretty effective though, because you know, if the organization's password policy is still maybe, I'll call it like traditional, right? So they have 8 character minimum, and then any 3 of the 4 uppercase, lowercase numbers or special characters, then oftentimes a lot of these guesses will fit that category. And if they're expiring passwords every 90 days, that kind of falls into like that seasonal rotation, right? Where users might be creating the password fall 2018 or fall 2018 with an exclamation. So again, it's all about the numbers game. Whose password did I guess? There's a lot of tools to do this against the Outlook web app. There's a Metasploit module. If you like Metasploit, there's a PowerShell script that we'll use, MailSniper, Python script, and then Verb Suite. Verb Suite is more of a full-blown web application testing tool. So if you were looking to find this behavior in like a traditional web app, then Verb Suite would be the way to go for that. But in our case, we'll demo this against Outlook web app. I like Outlook web app a lot because a lot of organizations use Exchange for their mail, right? And to make that available externally, they need OWA. So we see this pretty commonly. So we'll take a look at this. Oops. Maybe not yet. So let's jump down to my. So I have a PowerShell window here, and I'm in my Mail Sniper folder. I have two lists of users. So this is kind of my first user list. So this is my list of potential usernames, and maybe we found these usernames from like, maybe we were Googling around, maybe we did some social media creeping, however, we found this list of users. So the first thing that we need to find from our mail server is the domain. So this timing vulnerability or timing difference only shows up when you try to log in with the user's full user account. So UPN user principal names need to be set up in order for this to work, but I find that that's pretty commonly set up. So that's gonna be hard to see. I don't know why it flipped the text to yellow, but our first command is invoke domain harvest. So we're gonna try to harvest the domain from our Exchange host, which is just gonna be mail.highpointnetworks.com. And so we'll run that. And so we see, it thinks, okay, well, I think this is what the domain is. Obviously, that's not our full domain. This thing can be kind of hit or miss sometimes, so you have to play around with it and figure out exactly what the internal domain is of the organization. But again, you know, that's kind of where your research would come in. But in our case, our domain is HPN, so it found our domain. So that was the first piece that we needed. So then next, we're just gonna feed it that list of users here, our user list. So our command for that is invoke username harvest, and that's probably impossible to read with the yellow. I apologize about that. So then we'll, again, we need to point it at a OWA instance, which is highpointnetworks.com. We need to give it the user list, which is just users.txt. And then we need to specify the domain that we just found, which is HPN. And hopefully this will run. Okay, And it wants a, it's going to write the users that it finds to a text file, so we'll call it found users, and we'll run that. And so this script is kind of interesting. The first thing it tries to do is determine like a baseline response time. So we can see right now it's just throwing usernames at it that clearly don't exist, right? And so notice the response time, that's in milliseconds. So it's about 2,800 milliseconds, or about 2.8 seconds for these usernames that clearly don't exist. So that's going to be kind of our baseline, our baseline response that we'll compare it to. And so now we're going to go into our list of users that we found. Hopefully, I guess it's going to keep baselining there. Okay, so there, tried Serena Williams. Doesn't look like she's an employee here. Neither is Tom Thompson or John Johnson. But then if we look, it hit James McGuire, and we can see that the response time for that was quite a bit shorter. That happened in about 100 milliseconds. Same thing with Jason Hawley here, and same thing with Mike Felton. So we can see that in this case, the response time for a valid user is actually quite a bit shorter than invalid users. And so total, you know, we think we found about 3 users. So we've identified a way that we can enumerate usernames. So then like the next thing we would do is, you know, I would just put together a massive list of usernames. And here I took the top 50 most popular male and female first names and just paired those up with the top 50 most last names out of the census. And so this is just a massive, massive list. Well, it's about 2,500 usernames, potential usernames total. And so I'll feed that in and I'll just let that run all night. And I've had cases where people aren't watching logs on their Exchange server, so I've let this run all night. I'll come back the next morning and I've had like 70 or so valid users. I can start my passwords for them. And they weren't watching the log, so they had no idea that any of that was happening. So that's kind of the Elk Web App timing vulnerability in a nutshell, I guess. So let's talk really quickly about what do we do now that we know that this exists, or how do we protect against this? And again, I'm going to start from the top. Sorry about that. So how do we fix this? This has been reported to Microsoft multiple times, and it's kind of like a head-in-the-sand thing. They're sort of ignoring it. But Microsoft officially recommends using cloud authentication, which means putting your Active Directory in Azure. Microsoft is really, really pushing the cloud stuff. When you do that, they have two features called like IP lockout and smart lockout. So they're saying once it's in the cloud, we can automatically detect and block this kind of behavior. Another thing you could try, if you're an Office 365 customer in your admin portal, they have what's called the attack simulator. And you can actually just password spray yourself. You can also launch a brute force attack and even launch really, really basic phishing emails. So if you're already using Office 365, that's kind of a cool test to see where you're at. The only catch is before they'll let you do that, you have to have MFA turned on, which I don't necessarily think is a bad thing, because that's also what I would recommend. Definitely get on the MFA. One thing to consider, at least for OWA, I've seen in cases where people have used something like Duo, and the Duo prompt happens after the username and password are fed into OWA. So in that case, you know, they could still enumerate usernames out of there. But even if they catch a password, then you know it's not really effective because they don't have the second factor. So something to think about. Other things you can do, event 4625, that's invalid login event on your domain controller. So you know you can go into Event Viewer and manually look for that kind of stuff. Event Viewer kind of sucks for that. So you know maybe kind of think about something like a SIM. Microsoft also has their ATA product. You can run that for 180 days for free. We stood one up recently. It's pretty good about like raising an alarm. But it doesn't give you all the information, and it's really not like a full-featured kind of SIM. It's really only looking at logs from your Active Directory. So something to consider, but still worth looking at. I think if you're going to defend a web app, where you have a web app that you're worried about, Review the password reset pages, look at your invalid login messages, make sure they're not overly verbose, and then, you know, really push the strong passwords down on the users of that. Sorry, I'll try to do this really quick. And then lastly, you know, maybe just stop people from creating these easily guessable passwords in the first place. So there's a couple third-party products that'll do this. They integrate with Active Directory. Otherwise, Microsoft will do that if your AD is in Azure. So again, they're pushing the cloud kind of thing. So that's really it. Sorry. Right to 4:46, so we don't really have time for questions, but I'll be at the booth all day tomorrow too, so you can swing by and ask any questions there as well. So.